What if there were a fountain of youth pill that could add decades to your life? Would you take it? Unlocking the Fountain is a podcast about the mysteries of aging and the scientific quest to slow, stop, or even reverse it.
When do you think we're going to have the first 150-year-old? I think that person's already alive.
Unlocking the Fountain. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
You're sitting at the bar. There's three people across from you, two Korean people around the same age, one white American guy, again, around the same age. You start to talk with your friend and say, I wonder how those people know one another. A situation just like that was the inspiration for the new movie Past Lives. Celine Song, the director, will tell you how she was one of the people at the bar that night and what it was they were doing together. That's coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
In Western philosophy, the idea of destiny or fate or like the love of your life or something like that is often something that you're trying to go get. But in Eastern philosophy, so much of it is about something that comes to you. You don't have to do anything. It just comes. It just walks in the door and it's your destiny.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. I want to tell you about this movie called Past Lives. It's one of the most talked about romantic films right now. It's from a Canadian director named Celine Song. She was born in Seoul, South Korea. She grew up in Markham, Ontario. It's about, let me see if I can do this. It's about a young Korean woman who immigrates to Canada. She ends up living in New York. She's married to a white American writer. Her childhood sweetheart from Korea comes to visit and everything we'll say gets unsettled. It's a beautiful movie. What I find really interesting about it is that it resists all romantic movie tropes. There's no massive speeches. There's no like bad decisions, sex scenes or anything like that. Celine Song talks about that in our conversation. She says she wanted to depict humans as we actually interact, not as the way films tell us that we interact. It's worth mentioning that this entire film is based on a situation that Celine actually found herself in. Now, the film got rave reviews when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. Here is my conversation with Celine Song. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Congratulations on the film. I really, really loved it. It did so well at Sundance. Mm-hmm. How did that feel? How did the premiere feel at Sundance?
Oh, it was so magical because I feel like before that moment, like, I think you don't know what's going to happen to the movie that you spent so many years making. And I think a part of the making of the movie is always like you try not to think about how people are going to receive it. All you can really do is try to make a movie that feels like true to you and then right to you and that you like, you know, that you love. And then you hope that once it's done, then you start worrying like, okay, yeah, but then now other people are going to enjoy this. Like, mm-hmm. I care about this movie, but are they going to care about it as well? So Sundance really was a revelation kind of a festival for me because it was a full house and the reaction and then the way that like people sort of were so connected to the movie that first time. I don't think I will ever forget that first time at Sundance. It's so special.
People weren't coughing. I mean, like I've heard first time filmmakers tell me that like when their film premieres for the first time, if someone like coughs, they're nervous about it or they're, you know?
Yes, no coughing. And I think that like near the end, I think that when I could feel that people were moved and some of them were tearing up or they're having a bit of a physical reaction too.
It's interesting that you say, you know, given that it's such a personal film, that people related to it that way, given that it's such a personal film. I was hoping you might tell the story. So the beginning of the film, I've never seen a film framed like expositionally this way before, which is so Nora, sort of the Korean-Canadian protagonist, is sitting, and you don't yet know who she is. She's sitting at a bar at like 4 a.m. with her white American husband and her childhood sweetheart from Korea, And the it's shot from the perspective of someone across the bar quietly going like, so what do you think their story is? And trying to guess how they all know one another. This happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me that story?
Well, you know, I feel like I found myself in a bar in East Village in that exact situation where I was sitting between my child sweetheart from Korea and my white American husband on the other side. And I was also translating between them because they didn't really speak each other's language.
Yeah.
And I was also, I was feeling like a bridge and a portal between these two guys too. And all I had to do was just exist as I am. And I knew both of them loved me or cared for me in different ways and different degrees and totally different language even. But I knew that just by being who I am, there was something really special happening where these two guys were trying their hardest to sort of understand each other or be with each other. And I think there's a kind of a sense of power that I felt in that situation that I think really was the initial impulse for the film. But the way that the movie begins is that it's a way to implicate the audience or to really introduce the audience to the mystery of the film. And the mystery of the film is who are these people to each other, right? And it doesn't seem like a really big, it's not really a whodunit, but it's not really a really dramatic kind of mystery. But it is a mystery that I think that can sometimes haunt us, right? Because I think that not all connections in the world is easily defined by words like partner, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, or something like that. Some relationships we have in our lives is really just hard to describe. It's ineffable. And I think that, to me, is what the relationship between Haesung and Nora is.
I mean, I couldn't help but notice you used the word implicate there. Mm-hmm. Implicate the audience. Like, implicate
yes.
us in that
yes.
we may have our own assumptions about how people can live their lives and our own, you know, by our parents or by what we've seen on TV. And
yes.
that there's more complexities there. Is that what you mean
of
by
course.
Implicate?
It's a bit of a confrontational thing, right? The implicating means it's like they're a part of the event that this is, which is these three people who's... It's really hard to tell who they are to each other in this
yeah.
bar. And the way that, like, I was thinking is, like, when I myself was sitting in that bar with my child sweetheart and my husband,
yeah.
I remember looking around the bar and seeing the way that people were sort of glancing at us and trying to figure out who we are to each other, because we are a weird trio. Clearly, two of us don't speak the same language. One person is sitting in the middle. It's a triangle, but it is, like, really polite and it's not really awkward. It's very, it's or at least it's trying really not to be awkward. There's a kind of a warmth to it, but it is strange. So
yeah.
I was just looking at them and I remember just really thinking, you know, like, oh, you guys have no clue. You know? You have no clue who we are to each other. And second thought was, I was like, well, what if I really did tell you? What if I really took the time to tell you who we were to each other? And that's how the structure of the film is. The first scene is an implication and a confrontation and a bit of like, wouldn't you like to know?
Yeah.
And guess what? I'm going to tell you, right? And then we go back to 24 years earlier, and then we start to live through to basically tell the story of who these people are to each other. And over time, you just the audience, when we are back in that bar, because near the end of the film, we come back to that scene in the bar.
You see what? You are working towards that scene that you saw at the beginning, at the end. Yeah.
Exactly. And then there, I know that the way that the audience is going to be watching that scene is going to be entirely different. Now they're going to have the whole story of their lives to sort of like back up the context of that scene. So everybody's going to be looking at these three people completely differently, even though only about an hour ago or something, you've seen them as strangers just trying to figure out who they are to each other. Now that you have an answer, now the mystery is some kind of solved. But of course, like all mysteries of this kind, it's never going to be completely solved because it's not even clear to them who they are to each other.
I think that's an important point, that like all mysteries of this kind is never going to be completely solved, because in narratives historically, like the idea of like watching a film or watching a play or something like that, your story would have played out very differently than it did in the film. So like mm-hmm. one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today was just the amount of like nuance in the film and the amount of like how it's more similar to how reality would actually play out. And I think while I was watching the film, I was watching it with a bunch of like preordained film beats that weren't coming. Well, let me give people listening to this an example. So, you know, as you mentioned, you explore the backgrounds of you know, how Nora ends up in the United States to begin with. You know, she immigrates from Korea to Canada with her family, you know, chooses the name Nora, you know, moves to the U.S. And then she meets her husband. And we're going to talk about the fact that a lot of this happened to you in just a second. I was expecting when her childhood sweetheart shows up later to like see her and see what was, and maybe even like take her back and follow, you know, so she, I was just waiting for the moment where she says, no, I'm going to go back to Korea. You know, this is that, you know, I've always been in love with it. That's sort of the story I was ready for. Mm-hmm. Or like the big dramatic, no, I'm going to be here in New York. You know, what, this is where my life is and I love you. And I was, when I was getting ready for this interview, I read something you said where you said something like, I wanted it to be even mm-hmm. between Nora's decision to go back to her childhood sweetheart. I don't think I'm giving anything away because there's not really a twist. I wanted it to be even between going back to Seoul with my childhood sweetheart or staying in the U.S. with my husband.
Well, I think that it's more that the kind of, it was just important to me that Nora and Arthur's marriage, which is the Arthur is the person that Nora's married to be a good one or the one that is worth staying for. So part of that is like at the end of the day, it has to be about love. It's about how much Arthur loves Nora. And part of the way that Arthur expresses love is not through possession. It's not, he's not saying it's like, I have you, you're my wife. You know, that's never the argument that Arthur is giving for why she should be with him. He's saying like, I know what you need. I know that what you need is for me to accept also that I cannot give you everything. Because I think the part of it is like when we're talking about mystery, also we are mysteries to each other anyway. Like I think that there is no such thing. We're all individuals and we're all mysteries to each other. There's going to be a part of another person that you're never going to know completely anyway. And part of what Arthur is able to offer is that I know almost everything about you. And I think that the parts that I don't know, I know that I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Not only is that okay, but I have to accept it because I love you. And part of being okay that I love you and it's okay is that I know that you have to close this chapter with your childhood sweetheart. I know that you have to have this goodbye. Mm-hmm. I know you need all this. And I'm not going to stand there and let the feeling that I have, the insecurities I have, or mm-hmm. jealousy I have, get in the way of you being able to say your proper goodbye. I'm not going to get in the middle of that because I love you too much for that. So having that kind of sentiment to me and being able to not only have the sentiment but to practice it, right, is to me is an amazing love story that is also the love story of this movie between Arthur and Nora.
But as a filmmaker, you did have to reject a certain cliche to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, of course. I think every moment of it really had to feel like, well, what is the actual way that this would be like? Or like, how does an ordinary person go through these events actually like this? And the thing is, like, the main part of the story is not like, will they get together? Will they not? Who will she choose? Or something like that, which I think are just like traditional tropes of a romantic anything. Because I think that's so often we think about romance as something that has to do with dating, which has everything to do with, I think, capitalism, which I think is, or some kind of objectification of that person where you're like, I'm trying to get a person.
I'm trying to get something.
Yeah, I'm trying to get something. I'm trying to have that person. I'm trying to steal that person or take this person. So there is a lot of conversation about what we call as love story that is actually so much more about taking and getting and that kind of a thing about of a person. But in fact, this movie very much, what was really important to me for this movie is that it has to be about love in its most central and purest form, which is the kind of thing that you can give without asking for anything in return.
And the sort of, I mean, that's beautiful. And the device that is sort of utilized in the film to sort of exemplify that, like, you can love someone, it may just not be the right time, or you can love someone even if you aren't going to be with them, is the, now I wrote it down, is this Korean concept, like, is it inyeon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so the concept of inyeon is like it's not only a Korean concept, it's a kind of an Eastern philosophy concept.
Yeah.
And the way that I sort of talk about it sometimes is like, in Western philosophy, the idea of destiny or fate or like the love of your life or something like that is often something that you're trying to go get. So there is a kind of a pursuit part of it. You go to try to find your destiny.
Yeah.
But in Eastern philosophy, so much of it is about something that comes to you. You don't have to do anything. It just comes. It just walks in the door and it's your destiny, right? So similarly, that's where the concept of inyeon comes from. It's a very commonplace thought. And what it is every person who enters your life, every person that you encounter in life is an inyeon. Of course, the relationship you have with the person who brought you a cup of water at a restaurant, that inyeon is maybe a smaller inyeon or a thinner inyeon than the one you have with your lifelong partner or your parent, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like you and I on this conversation, like talking to each other, this would count as inyeon as well. So it is something where every relationship that you have, no matter how brief or how long, can be considered inyeon in that way.
And this would be stronger than the someone pouring water on the...
Yeah, exactly. Because right? You and I are actually having a conversation.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it's not a matter of like, is it inyeon or not? It's more like the degree. But the reason why I wanted to introduce the concept of inyeon to this film is because Haesung and Nora in the movie, their relationship is not something that you can really define with a word. Like I was saying, with the word like lover or an ex, because all they ever did was hold hands as children.
Yeah.
So they're not really exes. They're not really ex-lovers. It's not really something you can really...
But there was something. There was some kind
exactly.
of...
Exactly. But that thing you're talking about, the something, right? The something, the ineffable something, this feeling that I know this person, or this feeling that we've known each other for a long time, which is like what we were talking about earlier about the two of them looking at each other, the silences or the gazing at each other. Like those are the kinds of things that you don't have a word for, except... I thought that maybe the concept of inyeon could help because I thought the idea of inyeon is something that you can really name who they are to each other. Who are they to each other is that they are inyeon.
What I find really interesting about this is that we're talking about it in such like a, and you're speaking so beautifully about it, but from such a like a 30,000 feet perspective, a little bit about like, oh yeah, and like this is how I wanted to tell this story and this is how, this is how I felt about love in this context and this is how I felt about acceptance and how I felt about, you know, being mindful of sadness while still being able to accept that you love somebody. But it is very looming in the corner of the room is that a lot of this story is at least rhymes with your own story.
Yeah.
It's not a documentary.
No, no.
But it rhymes. I mean, like immigrating. She's a playwright, like yourself, immigrating from Korea to Canada at like 12, moving to New York in your 20s, also meeting your husband who's white at a writer's retreat in Montauk. This is all your story. Mm-hmm. My question isn't so much what are the similarities and differences between you, but it's what did writing the story that's so similar to your own allow you to maybe explore about your own story?
I think that so much of it, because I do talk about it as like an adaptation of or inspired by. And I think a part of it is that like it really made me hone in on a certain truth about what it's like to be myself in a way. And I think a part of it is it's not an question of identity almost. It's almost a conversation about existence. So it felt like how specific I needed to get about the way that it feels to be myself. And of course, in the making of the movie, it is going to be a different kind of exploration and different kind of forward movement towards becoming a movie, including like, you know, you cast actors, right? I'm not trying to cast actors that's going to replicate something. I'm casting actors who's going to play the characters. So I think that the bone of it was like the specificity of it, I think, was something that I had to feel very connected to. And I felt like had to be pulled from personal story.
And, I'm stuck on what you said, where you said, I wanted this film to feel like what my life felt like as opposed to the facts of my life. There's something, I don't even know how to describe that. There is the feeling of the experience of going through what I went through that is more authentic to me that I can actually probably tell in this film than going over the elements of my life.
Yeah, because it just has to feel right in telling the story.
Okay, well, this is I don't really know what else I have to ask you. I mean, it's a really, really beautiful film. And I really loved getting the chance to talk to you about it.
It was so fun. This was such a good conversation. Oh, thank you for talking to me.
Get out of here.
So good.
Come
on.
Get out.
When
are you going to make your Markham film, is my question.
When am I going to make a Markham film? Soon, you know?
When that Markham film comes out, I want 10%. My conversation with Celine Song, the Korean-Canadian director, screenwriter, and playwright, talking about her debut feature, Past Lives, which I heartily recommend. I absolutely loved it. It's in theaters tomorrow.
What should I say if I can't say hello? Do I replay all of the words you already know? You moved on.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. That's Matt Anderson. I talked about Matt Anderson so much in my life because he's just one of the most dynamic live entertainers I've ever seen in my life. I've watched him go on stage a couple of times, like, by himself, just an acoustic guitar. He sits down on a pretty normal chair in front of a microphone, and he can captivate and hold a room like nothing else I have ever seen. He's such a powerful solo performer, and if you get the chance to see Matt, it sounds like this, right? You're going to love it. But on his latest record, Matt did something really interesting. He decided to enlist some extra hands to help him out. A lot of extra hands, actually. Matt's new album is called Matt Anderson and the Big Bottle of Joy. That big bottle is made up of an 8-piece band, some of Atlantic Canada's best musicians. And from what people are saying about it, that bottle is popping. Very sorry. Here to introduce a song is Matt Anderson. Here's our conversation. Matt, how are you?
Good. The bottle is popping. I like that. I've heard that yet.
You can use that. I mean, we're very reasonable.
Absolutely will. Absolutely will.
Tell me a little bit about how you decided to put this kind of gigantic band together.
At first, it was just a fun idea. You know, I wanted to kind of have a band like this for a long time. So through the pandemic, we had a chance where everybody wasn't on the road. You know, usually different members are out with people, different bands or doing their own thing. So I kind of took advantage of people not being able to travel anywhere. And we threw some shows together and loved it. Just, it was an absolute blast. And it was an automatic, this is the band that I want to record with. This is the band I want to take on the road, and just made it happen.
It feels like a draft situation. Like you got like the number one pick for the team, and you got to pick exactly who you want for this band.
It is. It's a dream team. It honestly is. It's I'm fortunate enough that we have all these people close to home, but I don't know if I could have reached further away. I would have gotten a better band. You know, I don't think I could have, for sure. I mean, it's such a unit, and it's the first time I've been able to tour with people who I have such a much in the history with. You know, Jeff Arston, who plays drums, he's been on 4 or 5 of my albums. Mike Farrington, the same bass player. Chris Kirby's been on tour with me a bunch. So it's, and Kim Dunn, I played with them all over the last 20 years. So it's got a different vibe going up this time, having that kind of history with people.
How does the feeling of having the band up there differ than being up there by yourself?
It's definitely a bit of camaraderie. You know, you don't have that when you're up there by yourself. I mean, it's a different kind of connection with the audience too, with just me and the guitar. And I can really appreciate that. You know, I love doing the solo shows. It's a lot more chill. I'm just telling stories and singing songs. It's kind of more how I grew up with music. But having the band is a little bit more how I grew up listening to music. You know, when I hear those Van Morrison records with Ray Charles stuff, and just, you know, having that, such an energy off the stage coming. It's just, you can't recreate 9 people with 1 person.
Can you pick a song off the record that maybe is particularly meaningful to you, and we'll play it after this interview?
I'll say what's on my mind. A lot of it for the arrangement ways, you know, it kicks off with the vocals right off the top, which is, we do that in the live show, and it's every night we do it, the first line comes out and you hear people gasp in the audience, and I love that. That gets me revved up for the rest of the show, because it's such a wave that hits you. And lyric-wise, I mean, I wrote this with Corey and Kirby, Chris Kirby, Corey Jeffrey, Chris Kirby in the band, and it just kind of also has been going through my head a bunch. You know, it's more of a, we've got to make an effort to be good to each other than be crappy to each other. And, you know, I love singing that out loud to people.
I was going to ask what the song is about. It's sort of a song about camaraderie, about trying to treat each other right.
Absolutely. That's kind of the vibe for the whole record. But yeah, that one drives home quite a bit with that one. It's pretty blatant in the chorus.
Matt, always love talking to you. Congrats on the new records. It's a beautiful record. Again, I encourage anyone who can go see Matt Anderson to go see Matt Anderson. Joy to have you here, man. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it, man.
I speak with Matt Anderson. His new album, Matt Anderson and the Big Bottle of Joy, is out now.
Can I tell you? Something I want to
living like we're consequence free. Jumping to our own.
From his brand new album, Matt Anderson and the Big Bottle of Joy, that was Perth Andover, New Brunswick's own Matt Anderson with What's on My Mind. Before that, you heard our conversation. That album is out everywhere now. That is it for this episode of Q. The other episode we have up today is a cool one. It's an encore presentation, as we call it in the biz. An encore presentation of my conversation with James Cameron, the director of Titanic, on the 25th anniversary of Titanic. I had heard this rumor that when they were shooting the film in Nova Scotia, they ate chowder one night that was laced with PCP. Like, I always wanted to know whether that was true or not. James Cameron will tell you the story exactly how he remembers it. All right, check it out. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.